Hello, America. It's Glenn and Stu, and we're here to tell you about today's podcast. Good one. Start with shooting in New Zealand. And, you know, who's to blame? Donald Trump, of course.
Oh, well, who else can you blame for any problem in America?
Right. So we kind of get into that. Also, you know, Beto, Bob Frank O'Rourke, as we like to call him here, we find out that he might be a little nuts. And Reuters actually held a story back when he was running against Ted Cruz. But now that it's a field where socialists can't agree, oh my gosh, look who found some new things about Beto O'Rourke.
On the New Zealand gun murders, we'll talk about that. The rates, the differences as to what's really happening with guns.
And Joe Lieberman joins us. I asked him... you know, what is it going to take for Democrats to wake up to see this is a dangerous, dangerous thing that's going on in the Democratic Party? And we'll talk a little bit about Tony Robbins and my meeting Tony Robbins this weekend and attending one of his seminars in Los Angeles, all coming up on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So I was with Tony Robbins this weekend in Los Angeles. I went to one of his events, and I turned off my cell phone. I turned everything off, only checked it once, and that was on Thursday night, and I checked it because people were talking about the shooting in New Zealand. I want to show you, play some audio here, because things have progressed over the weekend on this. Let me play the audio of CARE director blaming Trump for New Zealand shooting.
Mr. Trump, your words matter. Your policies matter. They impact the lives of innocent people at home and globally. And you should condemn this, not only as a hate crime, but as a white supremacist terrorist attack. And you need to assure all of us, Muslims, blacks, Jews, immigrants, that we are protected and you will not tolerate any physical violence against us because we are immigrants or we are minorities.
This is
attacks
unbelievable. Okay, stop. I've had enough propaganda. Remember, this is what CARE is. CARE was started by the Palestinian Committee, which was funded and started by the Muslim Brotherhood. They started two organizations. They started Hamas, and then the Muslim Brotherhood needed another arm outside of the Middle East. And so in America, they started the Palestinian Committee. The Palestinian Committee had three founding members of their propaganda arm. The propaganda arm, it was started by that guy you just heard. He's one of the guys that was on the committee that started the propaganda arm here in the United States for the Muslim Brotherhood called CARE. That's who they are. And that's the way they should be introduced every time. The propaganda arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with anything that he said about condemning this violence, that no immigrant, nobody should be under this threat. No one should be. However, for him to say that it is Donald Trump's fault is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Donald Trump is responsible for this. When was Air Force One down in New Zealand? Did he make a state visit to New Zealand? Because I don't remember that. Anything anybody in New Zealand saw came from the mainstream media. Came from our media. And then the media in New Zealand picking it up. So if you really want to have direct blame, I think it would be from the media. And what the media is saying, although that, too, is ridiculous. The guy who's responsible is the guy who walked into the mosque. Period.
It's a bizarre sign of how we worship the president as a position in this country, that we need him to come out, and every time there's a crime, for him to say, well, this type of violence is unacceptable. We have a constitution that says that. We have laws that say that. We all know that you cannot go into a church. There's no way to justify it. There's no one who thinks it's okay. You do not need the president to come out every time and tweet to you his disdain for a particular attack. Just like when Christians are being slaughtered in the Middle East that the media did not step up and cover at all when that was going on. We all know that these are terrible, terrible things. The idea that the story today is whether the president tweeted about it or not is disgraceful. It takes a really serious incident with really serious problems and you know, degrades it to nonsense.
I will take a slight difference.
How dare you? How dare you? You agree when I say things, Glenn.
There are times that it does matter. If you come out and say something, for instance, if you are proposing legislation to kill infants and commit infanticide, it is important that you come out and say, I am against this. However, the president has said, I'm against this. We're all against this.
Inexplicably, there are two sides to that one, where half of the country, one major party, is saying, yeah, we should be able to do that. So taking a stand on that one's pretty clear. There's no party that I know of outside of legitimately white supremacists, which we saw in Charlottesville. It was like the Super Bowl for white supremacists, and like 100 people showed up. So, I mean, this is a look. One person can do a lot of damage, and so as we've said a million times, this sort of nonsense should go away, and it's despicable. But you know, there's not a huge white supremacist movement in the United States.
Nor is there one in New Zealand.
No, there's the one in New Zealand.
There's
right.
not one in New Zealand.
You know, either. And there's so the idea that needs to be the story today, I think, it's a sign that every single story has to come back to Donald Trump to punish us for some ill we did thousands of years ago or something. Every single story has to be about Donald Trump. Is there anything that we can talk about? I can't even watch football anymore without them bringing up Donald Trump. He's the president. It's supposed to be a role. It's not even co-equal branches of government. Congress is superior to the president in our system. We can't, but yet all we do is focus on the president and what he's tweeted in the last 24 hours. I mean, all the coverage this morning was about because he's tweeting about some show on Fox. Why the hell are you covering him tweeting about the Fox lineup? Who cares what he's saying about the Fox lineup? Like, they act as if, like, he must step up and talk about the important things. What are you doing? You're making decisions on your programming based on what one man is tweeting every day. The worst title of any news show in modern history has to be CNN's New Day, because it's always the same day. The same day, every story's the same, no matter what's happening. It's the same day. All days are the same day. There are no new days on CNN.
All right, let me go to the Prime Minister of New Zealand. This will make you very, very grateful you have a Second Amendment. Listen to this.
While work has been done as to the chain of events that led to both the holding of this gun license and the possession of these weapons, I can tell you one thing right now. Our gun laws will change.
Now listen to this.
There have been attempts to change our laws in 2005, 2012, and after an inquiry in 2017.
Got it. Stop. They have tried to change the gun laws over and over again, but the people won't do it. The people won't do it. So now that everybody's ramped up and angry, the government can just step in and say, we're going to change the laws. That's the worst thing I've ever heard. That's absolutely the worst thing I've ever heard.
That's an amazing admission, right? They're admitting what we're looking for is we're looking to take people who are emotional about a terrible incident and exploit that emotion to have them, to make them do things they, when soberly thinking about the issue, didn't want to do. They didn't want to do this before when there wasn't a terrible tragedy, but maybe if we try to take advantage of their emotion, they'll do it this time.
You know what's amazing?
And that's an admitted strategy.
What's amazing to me is where does racism come from, really? When this shooting, where did it come from? It came from irrational thought. Emotional, irrational thought. Mm-hmm. It came from, I'm losing my country and we're losing our way and nobody's doing anything. I gotta grab it. Gotta go kill everybody. Mm-hmm. That's where that comes from. And what is the media and the politicians, what are they encouraging? Irrational thought. Who is talking about rational thinking? Nobody. Nobody is. Nobody is. This is the result of not being rational. This is the result of doing everything your mother and father told you not to do. Calm down, calm down, calm down. You know, yeah. I have a completely new understanding for the English in World War II. I always thought it was kind of a, let me drink my tea with my pinky in my hand and maybe we can have some crumpets as well. let's have some biscuits. Whenever I saw the World War II poster that says "Stay calm and carry on," I've always thought, just stay calm. The Nazis are coming.
Don't stay calm, right?
They're blowing you up. Stay calm and carry on. Yeah. Yeah. That's be rational. Don't think of the giant evil, the literal evil that is right across the water. And they're coming for you. They're coming to destroy you. Their poster was, keep calm. Carry on. That's the best advice I've ever heard. And it didn't really occur to me until last week when everybody is freaking out about everything. And I thought to myself, everybody just needs to keep calm. Oh, my gosh.
You're the poster guy.
I'm the poster guy. Stay calm, everybody.
Yeah.
Because you can't make any good decisions.
You never make them in that position. I mean, we all know you don't go grocery shopping when you're hungry. We know that much, but we're going to make gun laws for a nation. Well, you don't.
I mean, my diet of Oreo cookies right. would radically change if I listen to your stupid advice.
The best of the Glenn Beck program. Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
I don't know if you guys saw this. Let me read what Beto said. You know that he had to apologize for his insensitive joke about his wife, which
I was not in the least insensitive.
I didn't think so either. I don't even know what he was talking about.
Strange.
Okay, here's one. Here's an article that he wrote, How the World Would Work Without Money. After changing the system, including the government, O'Rourke foresaw the end of starvation and class distinctions. Quote, to achieve a moneyless society or have a society where money is heavily de-emphasized, a lot of things are going to have to change, including the government as we know it. This is where the anti-money group and the Disciples of Anarchy meet. O'Rourke wrote under a pseudonym, I fear we will always have a system of government one way or another, so we will have to use other means other than totally toppling the government. I don't think the masses would support such a radical move at this time. Yeah.
Darn.
Yeah.
The things you worry about as a teenager.
Yeah, right.
And how old was he then? Was that the 15-year-old Beto?
No, this was that was something else that he wrote. This is, he's still a teen, but it doesn't give the age. Let me see if I can find the actual article. Does not give a date. Yeah, 1987. So it's in that.
Okay, he's
15. The cult publication that he wrote for under a pseudonym.
And again, it's more than anything, it's weird. Right, it's a little weird. I don't think it means he can't be president because he wrote strange things in 1987.
I don't know. You know the whole killing children thing. That's
is
weird.
Pretty weird.
But, I mean,
Beto Bundy doesn't need to be president of the United States.
But you know,
I'm not voting for Beto Bundy. I don't know about other people, but I'm averse to that.
It does sort of. There's a symbiotic relationship between the new abortion policy of the Democratic Party and these writings. However,
they seem to be embracing death an awful lot. They just kind of like death a lot.
It's like a death cult now.
Yeah.
They love it.
It is. It is. By the way, we have Joe Lieberman on in an hour from now.
Oh.
I'm anxious to hear.
I'm guessing Joe's not part of the death cult.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm anxious to hear his view on what is it going to take for, you know, the Democrats like him, if there are any. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean the ones in Washington. I mean the ones that live in our neighborhoods. Get them to wake up and go, wow, this has changed a lot. This is not the Democratic Party that we knew. This is a dangerous cult.
I don't, you know, I know Bill Clinton's not spoken out about this, but the way he governed, he shouldn't be able to even recognize people in the party now, because he wasn't this extreme.
I mean, we've come a long way since 2008, you'd agree, I think.
Yeah,
I think
we've come a long way since 2016.
Uh-huh. Right, I know. I mean, but consider again that Joe Lieberman spoke at the Republican National Convention in 2008. I mean, he was the Democratic Party nominee for vice president in 2000. Like, it went that far. The guy went from the standard bearer, basically, of the party to speaking and almost becoming the vice presidential candidate for the other party 8 years later, and it's gone much further since.
He was ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. He was really ahead of his time when he saw the extremism starting to take root, and he knew, I don't think he has any love for the Republicans. I mean, I don't think Joe has a bad bone in his body, so I doubt he hates anybody. But he doesn't necessarily have any love for the Republicans.
No.
I think he just has recognized way early, before any of us really, how dangerous this was becoming. And now I can't think of another name other than a cult. You know, a cult doesn't let you out. A cult, I mean, think about what do they say, this the Scientologist thing. They get information on you, and then they hold your feet to the fire. And if you want to leave, they're not letting you leave. They're not letting you leave. They'll destroy you before they let you leave. You come out, you try to say something against them, they destroy you. It's a cult. That's what this is. The Democratic Party has become a death cult. And they will destroy. Look at what they're doing. They destroy. It's like you get up in the morning. Who are we going to destroy today? And we're just following along. And they mean it. I mean, when Van Jones is not comfortable or welcome, look, he spoke at CPAC. Now, he got all kinds of trouble for it. And, you know, that's a whole another issue. He got a whole bunch of trouble for speaking at CPAC from the right. And I think rightfully so. However, he's reaching out going, I don't really have a home here. I don't have a home. I don't have a home in the Democratic Party. I don't have a home here. The guy was a communist. May still be a communist. He was
a revolutionary communist.
Revolutionary. This guy was the most radical guy in the Obama administration, and he's no longer welcome.
It's pretty amazing.
What's that tell you?
Yeah, when you think about Van Jones speaking at CPAC, that's certainly something you couldn't have imagined in 2010. We could not have imagined that.
No. Because that's not like Joe Lieberman speaking at
not
the GOP.
At all. No.
This guy was a revolutionary communist.
Things change fast, though. I mean, had you heard the name Beto O'Rourke as a 2 years ago? I mean, I guess he was in Congress, but he was a completely
unknown
member of Congress. And now he's the biggest fundraiser in history.
Well, Nancy Pelosi couldn't even name a single accomplishment when she was asked the other day. Mm-hmm. What did Beto O'Rourke, what would you say his major accomplishment was? She just babbled about energy for the next 3 minutes.
She's babbling about it. She can't even say,
what did you have
for breakfast this morning? She has no idea. She's kind of lost her marbles.
I think something's wrong with her.
I do too.
Yeah. Dr. Drew thinks something's not right with Beto O'Rourke, too.
Dr. Drew. All right, good.
So, this was before all this stuff broke about the children, the fantasizing of running over children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting because from the time I first saw him, it did seem something's not quite right with him. And now we're seeing some of the evidence of, you know, when he's writing at 15 and 16 years old about killing children, and then doing poems about how he needs a butt shine, and he's talking about cows. Did you read that one?
No.
I didn't read
the cow butt shine poem.
Some good stuff.
I'm not at that point with my relationship with Beto.
I am.
Are you?
Yeah, okay. We're like this.
All right.
He authored a poem called The Song of the Cow.
The Song of the Cow.
And an excerpt is, "I need a butt shine right now. You are holy, O sacred cow. I thirst for you. Provide milk. Buff my..." I'll say giblets. He used a different word. "Love the cow. Good fortune for those that do. Love me. Breathe my feet. The cow has risen."
It's powerful.
"Wax my A word. Scrub my giblets. The cow has risen. Provide milk." If that isn't the next president of the United States, I don't want to live in this country anymore.
That type of poem powerful. Is the surest path to the presidency.
What the hell is that? So what does Drew say about him?
So he says that something is just off. Something is wrong with the guy, and he can't quite put his finger on it, but there's something not right. I don't know what it is. And he has promised to get back to us when he figures it out.
Okay. So, all right.
He
okay.
couldn't tell by the bizarre hand gestures constantly.
No.
I was very happy to see Jimmy Fallon pick up on that particular thing that Beto does, which he has the very strange hand gestures. When you're thinking about the presidential like nickname that Beto would surely get, I think Sweaty Beto is a good one, because if you ever watched him in Texas, you notice every time he's on a big debate stage, if he's doing a big speech, he's very sweaty dude.
Oh, and it's completely pitted out.
It would totally get into his head to use Sweaty Beto, and it has a nice ring to it. Although I also like Wacky Waving Inflatable Arm Flailing Tube Man Beto, because
he is a little long. Yeah.
But he's
is
a little long for Twitter.
Yeah.
You know.
It is a little long for Twitter. Mm-hmm. However, him standing out in front of a mattress store doing a speech is exactly the same thing.
Exactly right.
How bizarre
was that when he announced next to his wife? I mean, he's sitting on a couch next to his wife. You've seen that video?
She seems like a hostage, not an admiring
right.
wife. Yeah.
And he is throwing down with the finger the whole time. One hand is just throwing down the finger like, "I will kill her unless you subscribe to my cult. I will kill her and her children." And you're like, wait.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and I want to tell you about something that you should either end your day with or start your morning with, and that is The News and Why It Matters. If you like this show, you're going to love The News and Why It Matters. It's a bunch of us that all get together at the end of the day and just talk about the stories that matter to you and your life. The News and Why It Matters. Look for it now wherever you download your favorite podcast. Senator Joe Lieberman, who has been a gentleman his whole career and has been a guy that both sides could look at, even if we strongly disagree, and say he's a decent man who just wants what's best for the country and we just disagree. Joe Lieberman joins us now in the program. Joe, how are you, sir?
Glenn, I'm much better after I heard your generous introduction. Thank you very much. It's great to be talking to you again.
Yeah,
our friendship goes back a lot of years.
It does, Joe. Really? Joe, I wanted to talk to you because of the op-ed that you wrote, but a little deeper than that.
Okay,
you talked about Ilhan Omar's comments about Israel, a moral test for the Democratic Party. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I must say that in my lifetime, I'd have to stretch to remember, and I can't remember another time when an elected member of Congress spewed forth that kind of explicit and really grotesque anti-Semitism. And I can't help but compare it to the experience I had in 2000 when I got nominated to run for vice president with Al Gore and first Jewish American to have that honor. And I didn't, people always ask me, did you face anti-Semitism? I honestly didn't. Wow, what a change. And to me, it was a moral test for the House of Representatives and specifically the House Democratic Caucus, because leaders affect the behavior of everyone else. And so here you have a congresswoman with a following saying something really contrary to all of our best values and the history of the Democratic Party, and it needed to be condemned with as much directness as she spoke, and it wasn't. I mean, what emerged was a hodgepodge resolution that seemed to condemn all kinds of bigotry, and I think it leaves her word standing, which is not good for the Democratic Party and not good for the country.
So you said that the Democratic leadership mumbled, and they must not mumble. They must be clear, which I agree with. But yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, there's a serious issue of this in the Labour Party over in England. And England has been going off the rails for a while on anti-Semitism, and we're seeing the same stuff happening, and it usually coincides with the rise in socialism and nationalism. When those things start to rise, I think that Jewish people are a canary in the coal mine. They're the first ones. So I'm looking at this. I'm seeing this. I'm seeing that the Senate would not take the easiest vote ever and say, no, we're not going to kill children after they're born. It's the easiest vote ever.
Yeah,
the number, there's not a single person running in the Democratic Party that will stand up and say that they are a capitalist. They hem and haw and mumble. What will it take for regular Democrats to wake up and go, wait a minute? And I mean even the ones in Washington, the Labour Party, you have party members standing up and exposing, and if they don't change it, they're leaving. Six of them have left. And I'm not saying where you go. I'm just saying, is there anybody that's going to stand up in this party and say, we're in trouble, guys?
Yeah. You know, it's the way you phrased the question, Glenn, is exactly right, because I know from personal conversations that there are a lot of Democrats in Congress who don't buy into this socialism as a solution to our problems, and the government can take care of everything, all your needs, and don't worry how it's going to be paid for, because it's going to be paid for by higher taxes, and it's going to be paid for by higher taxes on the middle class. But they're intimidated, I guess, and to some extent this happens in both parties in different ways.
Yes.
By the active minority. But honestly, for me, to look, capitalism has worked here, and we found our own way to do it. It's not pure capitalism with the markets just take care of everything, because we've added support for people who can't take care of themselves. We've done some regulation, maybe sometimes too much regulation, but wow, has this system worked? And you know, it's still working today. I know there are still some inequities. I know some people have fallen outside of the economic mainstream. But look at the unemployment numbers. They're so low. Look at the stock market continuing to be high. I mean, this is still the greatest economy in the world. So why would you want to dump it for something that failed miserably in the Soviet Union and Cuba and now is just ruining a wonderful country, which is Venezuela? It just makes no sense. And I think it's following the mob. But that mob does not constitute, in my opinion, a majority or even a plurality within this country. And for me, it's the way the Democratic Party makes itself into a losing party, not a successful winning party again.
So, Joe, I'm having a hard time convincing my audience, and I believe this, and I think the majority of I can't even say this. I don't know how many people believe this, but I do, that the average Democrat who is my neighbor is not for infanticide, not for an end of the free market. They're not anti-Semites. They're not for any of these things. But what is it going to take to wake them up to the hijacking of this party? Because if it's dead, it's dead, right, if it doesn't wake up.
Right. So I agree with you, incidentally, totally, that the loudest voices in the Democratic Party, and it's either in Congress or it's the candidates for the presidential nomination in 2020, honestly do not represent the rank and file of the party. And listen, the best way for that to be changed is for the Democrats who are mainstream Americans, very loyal Americans, not socialists, certainly not anti-Semites, to come out and vote in the primaries and hopefully find a candidate that they feel reflects their point of view. I want to say, looking at the House of Representatives itself, and I got involved in the last election with a group called No Labels that was working to elect center-right Democrats and center-left Democrats, center-right Republicans, to try to create a center group which will work together, negotiate, compromise, get something done. And really, the Democrats took over the House of Representatives majority, not because of Ocasio-Cortez or Omar or Tlaib. It's a whole bunch of really first-rate centrist Democrats who believe in the things you just talked about, Glenn. And incidentally, they had to do that because they won swing districts or even Republican districts, and with the kind of socialistic and occasionally anti-Semitic extreme rhetoric, they never could have won those districts. So that's the hope of the party, if they will stand up, speak out. This is why I said that the House Caucus of Democrats failed the moral test, because they kind of covered over Congresswoman Omar's error, her evil. And once you do that, it's an old line from Dante: the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of moral crisis, try to preserve their neutrality. Mm-hmm. It's not time to mumble. It's time to stand up and speak clearly against this nonsense.
So do you see, and let me ask Stu, mm-hmm, because he's been following this. Is there a single person, Stu, that has come out? I mean, even CNN blasted them for this. Is there a single candidate that has come out that has said they are a capitalist? Because you said, Joe, vote for somebody who is not that way. Is there a single one so far?
On the capitalist question, there has been a couple. Even Elizabeth Warren claims to be a capitalist. I think Beto said that this weekend.
Okay.
But I mean, even without using names, I'd be curious, Senator, what is the number of, there's 15 announced candidates. Is there, you have an idea of the number of those candidates that represent what you believe is the average regular Democrat?
You don't have to use names.
No, I'd say right now, based on what I've heard, probably two or three aspire to it. It's really shocking, and they've gone way beyond. Just look at recent history. Who are the Democrats who won? And I'm not saying you have to say they were, you loved them or you hated them, but Carter, Clinton, and Obama. Now, Obama was probably the furthest of that group to the left, but you couldn't say he was an extremist the way he ran. He ran on American values, et cetera, et cetera. So here's the encouraging thing. If I'm right, there's only two or three of the 15 who feel this the way we've talked about, the way that actually has a chance to get a majority or a plurality of votes. Then the others are going to split up that other vote, and maybe one of those centrists will have a chance to actually get the nomination. Honestly, we can hope and pray, because, look, America needs two strong parties that are not extremist parties. That's been always been our hope, and it's always been what's worked for our country, because ultimately they get together and they solve problems. I mean, President Reagan, Tip O'Neill, President Clinton, Newt Gingrich, really. Very different, but they all those pairings rose to the occasion, and we desperately need that to happen
that,
again.
That took courage, and I see it very rarely. And I've posed these same questions to Mike Lee. What is it going to take, Mike, before somebody stands up? Because I really believe, Joe, that the wall We don't want a wall because it's racist. We don't want a wall because we even think it's really that effective. We want a wall because we don't believe Congress will actually do anything that will last. They can say one thing, but then they'll go and do the opposite, either after the next election or even when they're not close to an election. The wall is really more of a statement, I think. The American people, at least those on the right, don't trust Congress or any administration to get this done and leave it alone and go with it.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot there in what you're saying, and this is actually a perfect example, Glenn, of what's wrong with our political system now, because we're fighting over something that really both sides agree on. And because, here's what I mean, because President Trump is so focused on the wall, a lot of Democrats are saying, well, the heck with that. I'm going to be against it if he's for it. But look back. I mean, under Clinton and Obama, money was appropriated and spent to build a wall in parts of the southwestern border. Last year, Democrats put up an immigration bill in the Senate, which didn't get passed. But it had a fair amount of money in it to build other parts of the wall and along the border. And I think the president understands that you can't build a wall. And he said this, you can't build a wall in every part of the border. It's just not topographically possible. And there's other things you can do. But does a wall help in some parts? Of course it does. Implement the rule of law, which is that we have rules for how you get in here. We're a country that's always been very welcoming to immigrants. They've been part of our strength, but there are rules. These are rules of law, and you can't just violate them without some response from the government. So, I mean, it's a classic case, and you're absolutely right. So people give up on the Congress. And tonight, if you look back at Obama, President Obama, he too started to govern by executive order on different issues, climate change, immigration, because he gave up on Congress. And in some ways, President Trump and a lot of people have done the same on immigration because they've given up on Congress.
Joe Lieberman, I miss you. It's good to hear your voice.
I miss you too, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're doing well. Regards to your family.
Thank you.
Take
you too.
Care.
Joe
Be
Lieberman.
Well.
God bless.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Obstruction of justice. I mean, this thing sounds like a spy novel. Luke Rosiak is the author of it. He is also a reporter of the Daily Caller, and I got him on for something that he wrote this weekend that I'm just not seeing everywhere. This should be the lead story everywhere. Suspect in Kavanaugh confirmation doxing has Feinstein ties, allegedly possessed Senate data, and the DOJ may hide the details. Listen to this story. I didn't want to bring you this story. I wanted the guy who found this story and has followed it and has all the information to tell you. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the doxing. Now, this is the letter that we all kind of wondered who released about Kavanaugh, saying that Kavanaugh raped me and all that. Is that the same letter?
No, it's actually a guy who, during the confirmation hearings, he went on Wikipedia and posted the personal addresses and phone numbers of all the Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. You found out that he has an awful lot of information because he was working where?
He was working for, at one point, for Dianne Feinstein and then later for Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire as an IT guy. And so here's what happens from the beginning. This is a rich, really rich, he's a socialist, he's a classic Bernie bro. He's a socialist now, but he grew up as the son of a CEO and one of California's biggest companies. guy is a big Feinstein donor. He built a university building named after Feinstein's husband. He's literally the chairman of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. His daddy's a really well-connected guy. So he gets this internship with Dianne Feinstein. He goes over to become an IT guy for Hassan, and he uses his powers as an IT guy to start downloading all the Senate's information, really sensitive stuff.
Like what? When you say sensitive stuff, like what?
Well, you know, the judge won't let me be in court to hear it because he says it's too sensitive for the American public to know what was taken. But that this is bad, this is worse than anyone knew. So basically what happened is he gets fired for Senator Hassan's office for reasons that she refuses to divulge. Oh, by the way, this is a felon when he was first hired. So Maggie Hassan hires a felon and gives him the keys to all of her servers.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he does something bad again. We don't know what because she won't say, and he's fired. And so then the eminent Sheila Jackson Lee over in the House hires this guy, even though he's just been fired and he's also a felon.
How is this happening? How is this happening?
So now we're up to the confirmation hearings of Kavanaugh. And, you know, Dianne Feinstein is architecting this whole plot on Kavanaugh with the Blasey Ford that you mentioned, et cetera. A lot of dirty tricks afoot. And what do you know? This Feinstein acolyte goes in and uses the data that he had access to as an IT guy to get all the information about senators' personal lives and expose it, where people could hunt them down and harm them and do whatever. I mean, this was a really heated time during those confirmation hearings. And so the problem is he snuck back into Maggie Hassan's office, which had fired him, to get to log on to their servers and download all this information. And they caught him in the act. And he said, well, you know, I have everything already. I've got your Gmails. I've got your Signal encrypted chats. I've got all the information about the senator's kids. If you tell anyone, I'm going to release all of that. And so he starts blackmailing Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan. So this is a bad, bad dude who had access to everything and is legit blackmailer. Hassan, the guy that he tried to blackmail, he didn't give in. He called the cops anyway, and the cops arrested him. And there was like literally one day of news stories about this in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And so fast forward a little bit and you're in court, and I'm the only reporter who bothers to show up because I thought during 2016, the Democrats really cared about political hacking. It turns out that they don't. They dropped this news story after 1 second because it was a Democratic guy. And so it turns out that he wasn't bluffing. When he said, I have everything, I've already got all the information, he wasn't kidding. He has everything. So now the prosecutors are saying, this is so bad, it's worse than we originally knew. It's so bad we can't even discuss it in court.
And yet, it looks like now they're going to settle? And this
That's
could
right.
be so, sealed?
Yeah, I mean, so there's really no basis, as far as what I can understand, for kicking me out of court. They let his mom stay. It's you'd think, with the sensational stuff that we just went through, you would think that at least one reporter from a mainstream news organization might think this is newsworthy, but that's not the case. It's literally just been me and his mom at each court date. And so they let the mom stay, and they kick me out for no good reason other than Dianne Feinstein is the head of the Judiciary Committee, which oversees all the federal courts. She's the guy that hired this guy. His dad is, you know, a big donor and a highly connected political guy in California. And so now, you know, America never gets to find out the extent of this frightening national security breach, this hack on the Senate. And so they use his money to get him out. And it's so funny because he's this skinny little white kid and he was freaking out about being in D.C. jail general population. And they said that openly in court. They said they got to get him out of Gen Pop. He'll do anything to get out. Please, judge. And so they bring the money in and they say, we've got teams of psychologists. We'll pay for the finest care. And so they get him out of jail, even though the prosecutor was saying, look, after we apprehended this guy, he was blackmailing us and saying, if you don't let me out of jail and drop all the charges, I'm going to release all the data that I have. That's obstruction of justice right there. This guy is a flight risk. This guy is a bad dude. You can't let him be out in society. And they use his connections and his money to let him out. They seal the proceedings. And now it looks like they're going to do a plea deal with him.
This is phenomenal to me. But it gets worse than this. You have a new book that is coming out, Obstruction of Justice. And this book is is a story that we covered through you. You were the only one really doing this and connecting all of the dots. You've put it together in a book, and everyone should read it. But it's so frustrating because nothing was done. And when Joe Lieberman was on just a few minutes ago and said, you know, I think the Democrats are afraid. Yes, they are afraid. And the Republicans may be afraid, too. But of whom?
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.